One of the major episodes in this week's Pasha, Parshas Matos, is the war that the Jews waged against Midian. Hashem told Moshe, Nikom nikmat b'nei Yisrael me'esa Midyanim, achar te'asef el amecha. Take the vengeance against Midian and then you will die. Then your life will be over. So Moshe organized the war. He set up troops, soldiers, and they, from each shevet, from the different tribes, and they set out to wage war against Midian. And they waged a very terrible war, a murderous war against Midian. It says by Yahargu Kol Zachar, a genocidal war. They massacred all the men. They killed the kings. Malchei Midian Hargu Al Chaalem. They killed the kings of Midian. It says they captured people. They captured the women. They captured the children. And it says they burned all the cities. They put all the cities to the torch. Kol Arehem Moshvosim. It's called Tirosim. Sarfu Beish. Beichu. It's called Ashalal. They seized all the property. It's called Malkach. Badim Vabehema. So they waged a terrible war against Midian, and they killed many, many people, and then they took a terrible, bloody revenge against Midian. The revenge was for what we learned about in the last few parshias, and Balak and Pinchas. They were responsible for Baal Peor, for the tempting the Jews to sin and causing all the problems there. Midian was having the story of the Midianis when Zimri took the Midianis in front of Moshe and brazenly flouted the halacha with her, and Pinchas killed him. And this was the culmination, the conclusion of that story with the massacre of the Midianim by the Jews. So the Herz Chumash, the Santino Chumash, I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, an old classic English Chumash, and it was written largely, it was edited by Dr. J.H. Herz, late chief rabbi of the British Empire. The character of the Chumash was that it was largely an apologetic work. It was written during the time where enlightened anti-Semites in England and Germany were looking down at the Jews. They looked at them as barbaric and primitive and old-fashioned. They weren't modern European. You know, in the 20th century, we see how good modern European democratic society has behaved. But at that time, there was a lot of pressure to defend, still is, but a lot of pressure to defend the Jewish people against charges of backwardness and anti-Semitism. So a lot of his comments in the notes are trying to justify things in the Torah against the criticisms of the modern Western anti-Semites. So the ruthlessness of this battle was something that apparently gave our enemies ammunition to criticize the Jews. So he writes as follows. The war against the Midianites presents peculiar difficulties, meaning that it's hard to understand how they could be so bloody, so ruthless. We are no longer acquainted with the circumstances that justify the ruthlessness with which it was waged. We don't exactly know what was going on there. Therefore, we cannot satisfactorily meet the various objections that have been raised in that connection. Then he quotes from some other English Bible who tries to say, you guys are not any better. You Englishmen are not any better. He says, perhaps the recollection of what took place after the Indian Mutiny, when Great Britain was in the same temper, may throw light on this question. The soldiers then, bent on punishing the cruelty and lust of the rebels, partly in patriotism, partly in revenge, set mercy altogether aside. That was a terrible story where the Indians were under the thumb of Great Britain, rebelled against the English, and the English put down the rebellion with tremendous brutality. They massacred, killed, destroyed tons of people. So they're pointing out, before you start looking at your nose down at the Jews, remember, war happens in every culture, and war is not a pretty thing. And so on. So that's what Dr. Hertz says about the story of Midian. So I want to take this opportunity to discuss in general what the Jewish attitude toward revenge in general is. Toward someone...
The war that you mentioned with the brutality, wasn't that commanded by Hashem to take that, to do that war?
Yes, that is an excellent point. That, as I mentioned earlier, Dr. Hertz is writing to modern non-Jews, and he can't just defend it by saying God told us to do it. That wouldn't be enough of an answer. The Muslims say that we go around massacring people because God tells us to do that too. He wanted a kind of answer that would be able to, right, you're right. The real answer for us is that God told us to do it.
But
Absolutely. That's why I gave that introduction. That's why I gave that introduction, to understand the context of Dr. Hertz's remark. He was writing to for the benefit of our non-Jewish critics. But today, exactly as you said, Phil, today I want to discuss what the actual Jewish attitude toward, as you said, Herr God told us to, but I want to use this as a springboard kind of to discuss in general what the Jewish attitude toward revenge is. Is revenge justified? What do we Jews do when somebody attacks us? Are we supposed to just do nothing? Are we supposed to fight back? Are we supposed to take revenge? What exactly? Obviously, this is a big topic. I want to just discuss a number of perspectives on this question that I find particularly interesting. Again, returning to the Christians, so the Christians explicitly reject Jewish attitudes there, at least in theory. Practice is another story, but in the Sermon on the Mount, one of the famous chapters in the New Testament, Jesus tells people, and the Torah says, ayin takas ayin, an eye for an eye. So Jesus says, you have heard that it has been said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And I say, if a man smites you on the cheek, turn the other cheek. Famous English expression, famous European expression, turning the other cheek, which actually is a biblical expression. It says, yitain l'makei ulechi. But in the Christian idea, means when someone hits you, you just don't do anything. You just take it, and you accept it, and you walk away. But that's not the Torah's attitude. The Torah's attitude is ayin takas ayin, an eye for an eye. So I want to discuss, again, from different perspectives, different ideas of what the Jewish attitude toward vengeance is. So one of the famous examples in the Torah of vengeance appears way back in Sefer Bereishis. Parshas Vayishlach. We have the story, the tragedy of Dinah. Dinah is Yaakov's daughter. She goes out and is seized and molested by Shechem, who was a local Canaanite prince. Shechem ben Hamor, Chachivi, Nasi Haaretz. He was one of the Chivites. He was Nasi Haaretz. He was a prince. He took her. He forced himself upon her. It says that Yaakov's family were furious. Her brothers, her family were furious. It says about Yaakov's sons, Yaakov's family. It says, Vayisatzbu ha'nashim v'yichar lehem ma'od. They were upset, they were furious. Ki nevala asa b'Yisrael. A disgusting thing, an outrage was perpetrated against Israel. Lishka b'spas Yaakov to do this to a daughter of Yaakov. V'chein lo yasa. This is not done, this is intolerable. So we know the story. They had the terrible revenge they took against Shechem. They tricked them into thinking they would be accepting them as converts. They did bris milas on them, and they were all sick. It says, v'hi b'yosim kavim, on the third day, they were all sick. So it says that the Shimon and Levi in particular, two of Yaakov's oldest sons, went into the people when they were at their most vulnerable state, and they wiped them all out. It says, Vayivo Alayer Betach, Vayargu Kol Zachar, they killed all the males of Shem, and they killed Hamar, and they killed Shechem, and they took back Dinah, and that's what they did to Shechem, the city of Shechem, the people of Shechem. So it says, the Torah tells us, when Yaakov returned, Yaakov was very unhappy with what they had done. They had apparently not consulted him, and Yaakov was very upset about what they had done. Yaakov told them, you did wrong. Achar Timosi Labisheni B'Yoshev Aretz. You have troubled me, you have disturbed my...
Where does he say you have done wrong?
I'm sorry?
It says you have done wrong, or are you saying
that? Yaakov says, that Yaakov's complaint they had done wrong. It says, Achar Timosi Labisheni B'Yoshev Aretz. Chartum is a tough word to translate. They translated it as troubled me, to make me odious, b'yoshev haaretz.
But that doesn't mean that they was telling them they did wrong.
I think
it means that they made him a target as an enemy. That's what troubled me about that. He doesn't tell them that.
Okay, so we're going to elaborate on that. Yeah, that is an interesting observation, and we're going to elaborate on that in a minute.
People are going to attack me. That's what
right.
It doesn't say you did wrong.
Okay, so he was worried they were going to attack him. Vanim say misbar. There are very few of us. Vanesfu alive. Vikuni bishmad. Yes, so I think he means the rest of the Canaanites. So this is only one city. I think there was still a whole country of hostiles and of people who were generally allied with the victims of Shechem and against Yaakov. Yoshev Aretz, Canaani, Prizi, those are the other tribes who lived in Canaan. So they answered back. Shimon and Levi answered, Vayomru achazon yaseh haseinu. Well, what else should we do? Look at what he did to our sister. How do you expect us to act? So the commentators are a little perplexed by this discussion. Yaakov's point was, what you did is very dangerous. Yaakov made a cold and calculating and careful, cost-benefit analysis, so to speak, of what's going to happen to us. They didn't respond to that. They didn't. They just said, they did something terrible to our sister. So what's the answer? Yaakov was saying it's very dangerous. So what was their answer? So I want to discuss three answers given by the commentators, all of which I think are quite interesting and all of which have, I guess, ramifications for public policy and even private conduct in Jewish affairs. The first answer I want to discuss is the Abarbanel. So again, the Abarbanel, to take him in context, Abarbanel was a 15th century Spanish nobleman. He was a Jewish leader, but he was also a very highly placed nobleman in Spain and Portugal. Yes, and you know, a lot of his attitudes, a lot of his ideas, you can kind of you get an influence of the high courts of Spain, of your European countries. He's always at his most interesting when he writes about politics, about monarchy, about government. So here he has an idea which very much reminds us of a Spanish nobleman from the 15th century. He writes that Yaakov said it's very dangerous, that we may die for this. And Shimon and Levi didn't disagree. They said, absolutely right. We agree with all your facts. We everything you stipulate is 100% true. We may pay for this with our lives. Their answer was, but it's the honorable thing to do. And his language actually is death with honor. Their attitude was death with honor is preferable to life with disgrace. Somebody insulted us. Somebody insulted our family. Someone did an act of dishonor against us. And even if we die for it, at least we'll have shown that we're men of honor, that we don't take these kind of insults lying down. And that's what we're going to do anyway.
Question.
Yes.
That's all very nice, but what's the Jewish law on that?
So that's an excellent question. And as I pointed
Jewish
out,
law, I don't think it's the death penalty.
So that is
for rape.
Right.
It could be.
Well, so there are two questions here. There are really two questions we have to consider in this story. One of them is why did the people of Shechem deserve to be killed? What did they do that was a capital crime? As another question, why were Shimon and Levi risking their own lives and the lives of their family by doing this? So the question about why. What they did wrong for what they did that was a capital offense, that is another question beyond the scope of our discussion, but the Rishonim, the medieval commentators, do discuss that. They give various answers, which are a little bit beyond the scope of our discussion. Some of them say that for Gentiles, theft itself is a capital crime. It's one of the seven Noahide laws, and rape is a kind of aggravated theft, and theft is actually a capital crime for non-Jews. Some say that it was a failure to enact a system of justice, a system of accountability and of justice itself is a capital crime for non-Jews. That is an important question, yes, to try to understand what they did. Some people just say that they were guilty of death for other reasons. They were idol worshippers. They were in general lawless murderers, and they deserved to be killed for other reasons. And they just took advantage of the story to decide, they couldn't kill all the idol worshippers, but they anyway didn't deserve to live. But there are different answers, and it's a tough question, and then the question may be better than the answers, but I'm focusing here on a different question, which was why do they risk their own lives? Rabbi Brunel says, very simply, because the honorable thing to do, in Europe there was a culture of dueling. You would have, if somebody insulted you, you would challenge him to a duel, and even if you die for it, but the honorable thing to do, a gentleman would risk his life. Today we have the same culture among some of the...
Could there be a difference between a personal attitude versus social attitudes in this case?
Yeah, so we will discuss that soon also. Some of the later tshuvos we'll see discuss as a matter of public policy what the... But many of the poskim, we'll see examples soon, many of the poskim seem to assume that even if somebody does something personally to an individual, on behalf of the community, the individual has a responsibility to take steps to fight back, because otherwise that gives a reputation that... We'll get back to that. We'll get back to that a little bit later.
But what do you have in the Muslim community?
They tricked them.
Yes, they tricked them. That's another good point, that they didn't do that. Right. Now, Rabbi Brunel, who's making a big deal about honor, would have to explain that they don't think... Not only that, there's a comment to the Ralbag that makes it especially sneaky. The Ralbag says that the way they did this, not only did they wait till they were sick, he says what they did was Shimon and Levi would go around to the people saying, it's the third day of the Mila, your men are sick. We're going to go and let us go inside and treat the patient. They would go inside, they would kill the guy quietly, then they would close the door, they would go outside and tell the family, he's resting, we performed some treatment, don't disturb him, don't open the door for another 2 hours, and they would go kill the next one. So it was not the most honorable thing in the world, according to the Pashup Shot, and certainly according to the Ralbag. Yes, according to the Bar Brunel, that they were trying to preserve honor, then right, I guess they would have a little explaining to do about how they could do it in such a dishonorable way. In any event, that is the approach of the Bar Brunel, that it was a question of honor.
Well, look, the Muslims also, but they have their honor killings too.
Right. Right.
They call it honorable in their value system.
Right. Today we have this, among the rap stars. One of them, they have beefs. One of them says, you insulted me, I'll kill you. Yes, we Jews do not usually look at this as the appropriate course of conduct. And I'm not claiming that this Avraham Brunel's view is the normative view, the well-accepted view, but it's just worth mentioning we have at least one major Jewish thinker who seems to think that this was indeed a Jewish attitude. We should point out, by the way, that Phil before was raising the question of whether Yaakov disagreed or not. So we have to mention in any discussion of this topic, we do have to mention that at the end of Sefer Bereishis, when Yaakov on his deathbed, when he gives his final blessings and his final statements to his children, he was very unhappy with Shimon and Levi. He said, "Klei chamas mecheiroseihem, weapons of violence, their kinship. Kiva apam hargu ish, they have killed somebody in their anger. Bertzonam ekrushar. Arur apam, cursed be their wrath. Ki oz, because it's mighty, it's too strong. Avrasam ki kashasa, their wrath, their anger is just out of control." So there are discussions in the commentators exactly what he's referring to, but I think pretty much everyone agrees. At least one of the examples he had in mind was what they did to Shechem. Yaakov was still apparently very unhappy with what he considered their temper. Yaakov was not happy with what they had done. But nevertheless, the Torah itself is not entirely clear as to who is right and who is wrong. And now we'll get to another couple of approaches to this question of what Shimon and Levi thought they were doing. That, too, again, two fascinating approaches in the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh.
How could if they're doing what's right by killing the people because they did something wrong, shouldn't they just kind of have faith in Hashem that since they're doing something right by executing
So that itself is also a very good question. The question also is going to be beyond the scope of our discussion. The whole idea of bitachon in general, if a person does a mitzvah, does the right thing, does he have to worry about consequences? So this is obviously a very important discussion that cuts to the core of Jewish theology. But in general, many Jewish thinkers have pointed out that even when one does the right thing, one still has to take reasonable precautions and not be reckless. So for example, we find the story in Sefer Shmuel where Shaul HaMelech is still king. And God tells Shmuel, go appoint David HaMelech. And God was angry at Shaul. He wanted him replaced. He said, go appoint David HaMelech. So Shmuel tells Hashem, how can I go? If Shaul finds out, he'll kill me. He was rebelling against Shaul's kingdom, least majesty. So the Jewish thinkers have all pointed out the fact that God told him, go do this, and still he answered back, and how can I do it? It is dangerous. So they say that's what God wants of us. God does not want us to be, even when we're doing a mitzvah, even when we're doing a direct commandment of God, you're still not supposed to be reckless. So of course, if God tells you to do it anyway, I know it's dangerous and do it, so you listen to God, you do it. But the point is, in general, just because someone has a mitzvah, just because you think it through and you decide that it's a Jewish value, but if it's really reckless, that may not be a good enough reason. You may have to either take precautions or not do it at all. But again, the topic is a complicated one. And
two of them wiped out an entire city.
That's true. That's another question. If they were really so tough, maybe they could have held out against all of Canaan. Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Brought up by Shmuel ended up bringing the cow for that reason.
What?
Yes, exactly right.
Shmuel ended up what?
He's pointing out that Shmuel ended up, God's answer to Shmuel was, take with you a calf, and if people ask you, where are you going? Don't tell them the truth. I'm going to appoint a replacement king. Tell them you're going to offer a sacrifice. That's exactly the answer. Hashem accepted that he was right, that he should not do this openly, and that was what happened. So we turn now to two very interesting approaches of the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh to what Shimon and Levi's answer was. First answer is that Shimon and Levi were arguing as follows. Yaakov said, we're going to be attacked by the rest of Canaan. And as you pointed out, Shechem itself was dead. The city of Shechem was wiped out, but Yaakov was worried about the rest of Canaan. Now, the rest of Canaan were just allies or friends or third parties. So Shimon and Levi were saying, if we started up with Shechem for no reason, if we launched an unprovoked attack on Shechem, then you're right. All their friends would be very upset, and they would say, how dare you start up with our people, and we're going to fight back. Says Aruch Chaim, Shimon and Levi were saying, they started up with our sisters. So the rest of Canaan are going to understand. They're going to say they were provoked. We understand why they did what they did. We don't blame them for doing this. You know, they got what was coming to them. You know, they might have been our neighbors, but they're the ones who started, not us. And whatever the Jews did was perfectly understandable because they messed around with their sister. That's what they were saying. Hakazoni Yasin of Seinu means the Canaanites, even the pagan understood that there's a difference between an unprovoked attack and between a justified retaliation. So they were saying they won't start off with us because they can understand what we did. one approach with Arachaim.
Still the entire city.
Yeah, okay. Right. You can, we can definitely debate the details, yes.
Dina put herself in a vulnerable position in the beginning of the whole thing.
That's true, but it doesn't justify being seized and kidnapped. And we might have argued it was a bad idea, because Al do criticize her for it, but it doesn't justify what they did. The fact that she walked out was reckless, or you know, she behaved, maybe according to Chazal, maybe a little bit less modestly than she should have, but that doesn't justify what Shechem did. It doesn't justify seizing a girl and forcing yourself upon her. So yeah, the fact that, so we get into the whole, you're raising the whole question of what they always talk about today, proportionality, and yeah, we could definitely debate the details and debate whether the Canaanite mind actually would have worked like this or not. But the idea is an interesting one, that even our enemies, or even the neutral third parties, sometimes, at least sometimes, will understand that sometimes what we do, they'll understand is justified if they see it as a legitimate response to a provocation. The third approach is also a fascinating approach. The second approach is Arachaim. The third approach we're discussing is also a fascinating approach, and it cuts to the core of this whole discussion. Shimon and Levi were telling Yaakov, according to the Arachaim's second approach, on the contrary, you think that we would have been safer if we had done nothing? On the contrary, Shimon and Levi said, we think that we're safer this way. Why? The calculus of deterrence. Deterrence means that one of the things that preserves the peace is, I don't start up with you, and you don't start up with me, because I know that if I start up with you, you're going to launch a bloody retaliation against me, and vice versa. That's what kept us going during the Cold War, between us and the Soviet Union. So the Arachaim says that that's what was happening here. Shimon and Levi was saying, if they start up with us and we launch a bloody counterattack, that preserves the balance of terror. The next enemy who thinks about starting up with Yaakov will say, these guys are ruthless. We start up with them, we can expect to have an all-out genocidal attack. So we better think twice before we start up with them. We don't do anything if we do what the New Testament says, turn the other cheek. It's open season. Everybody will say, all right, you can start up with Jews and nothing happens. You know, they just roll over and play dead. So what's to stop us from doing this again? So the safest course of conduct, they say, is, it might be a short-term risk to fight back, but in the long run, at least, the safest course of conduct is to show the enemies that we will not tolerate aggression. We will not tolerate being attacked like this, and they should know that they're going to pay a price. If anyone attacks us, they will pay a price. And this idea of the Arachaim, I want to move. Sorry?
It's kind of like a mole.
Yes.
That's
right.
How did they attack the Jewish people?
In this case, they raped a young girl.
Yeah, they raped the girl. They didn't launch an attack and start against the whole nation and start killing people.
No. But
attack against an individual.
Yeah.
That makes the same thing.
But the point is, they'll do it again. And then it'll happen again tomorrow.
If you take the king's daughter, it's an offense against the whole country.
It's also true, certainly because Yaakov was like a leader, or Yaakov was regarded as a nobleman, an aristocrat.
Right, it's an act of war when you...
All right, she probably didn't identify herself in the middle of the forest either, you know. Here I am, you know, like, how'd you, nice meeting you, you know. It's like, oh, by the way, I'm Jacob's daughter, who are you?
So I want to move on now and discuss several other examples where we're going to see Poskim, actually, in the Shalos and Tshuvas, Halacha L'maaseh, where Poskim have used the same argument to justify revenge. For exactly this reason, because...
So now you have two arguments. One is honor.
Right.
Right. And the second one would be to stop any further aggressions
right.
in the future.
Yes. Two separate things. Right? I'm going to focus mostly on the second one now, to stop future attacks. So I want to discuss a few important shuvas in the postgame where postgame have made this argument as a reason for pursuing revenge. One of the most important shuvas is a shuva of the Tzemach Tzedek, an early Acher, and not the more recent one from Chabad, an early Acher from about 300 years ago. He was talking about a case, and again, we were just discussing the difference between the king and the common person. He was talking about a common person. There was a Jew, a private citizen, who had been murdered by a non-Jew. And the Jewish community felt it would be possible to achieve justice, but it would cost a lot of money, just like today. You know, fighting things in court costs money. You know, hopefully the government does a lot of that themselves, but in that time, they needed a lot of effort by the community to push for it. They had to hire lawyers, they had to pay people off, to cooperate with them. You know, life wasn't always easy. And it would be a major effort to bring the guy to justice. And the question was, is this the right thing to do, and should we spend, and are we really mechuyev to spend a lot of money, a lot of effort to get the criminal caught and punished. I mean, I don't know if punishment meant executed or jailed, whatever it was. Should we, the Jewish community, should we make a difficult and expensive effort to bring the guy to justice?
Also, if you do it eventually, then the rest of the Jewish community can get
you. Yeah, right. That was part of the arguments in Yaakov and Shemuel Levi, the same argument. But Tanakh Tzedek says unequivocally, absolutely yes, it is the obligation of the community, he says, to pursue the guy and bring him to justice, even if it's expensive. He says the community should bear the burden. And the argument he makes is this second argument of deterrence. It's important, he says, for our enemies to know that the blood of Jews is not hefker, that there's a price to pay for killing Jews. He wasn't talking about vigilantism, about taking the law into your own hands and killing the guy, but he was talking about working through the governmental process. But he says it is very important to make sure that the murderer, criminal, pays the price and is indeed punished for it, in order that our enemies should know that there are consequences. If there's going to be a price, he does not raise the idea you're bringing up, that maybe that'll lead to a cycle of violence, future counterattacks, and maybe he felt that wasn't a realistic possibility in his case. I don't know. It's an interesting point. You have to consider all angles when you do something like this. But in any event, he felt that the basic idea of preserving deterrence was important enough that it should be a communal priority to spare no effort to bring the guy to justice. We find a similar idea in the tshuva a couple hundred years later, in the tshuva of the Divrei Malkiel, around 100 years ago. He was asked about a case, again, a Jew was murdered, and the community believed, I don't know if they had actual proof, but they believed that the murderer was a certain non-Jewish person. They wanted to file a criminal complaint against him with the government, the Polish or European government, whatever it was. And here it wasn't a question of expense, that wasn't the issue. A very interesting problem. The problem was the Jewish murder victim had already been buried. And if the Jews would file a complaint and the government would open a criminal investigation, they would exhume the body, they would dig him up, and they would perform an autopsy, and part of the investigation would be to desecrate
the body of
Yeah, desecrate the body of the dead. And we know Halacha does not like that generally. Halacha considers it, again, a priority to preserve the honor of the dead and not to desecrate the dead. Here, the Jews wouldn't be doing it themselves. The government would do it. The question was, again, it's like grama, like we discussed. It is only a grama, but the question is, all else being equal, you really shouldn't be guarding. You shouldn't even indirectly cause a Jewish body to be desecrated. So the question was, is it worth it? Should we open?
When you go through the legal procedures, right? So you hire a lawyer. That's not revenge. That's justice.
Agreed. So the title revenge might not be the right word, but I'm talking about in general things that are connected. Or you're right. The revenge might not always be the right word.
We have a separate justice system. We don't consider a lot of that as our as for us justice. Justice is for Jewish courts. So this would only be halakhically permissible for us to the point where it would prevent other people from messing with us in the future. Otherwise, we don't consider it.
I think you're both right. I think that certainly when the Torah talks about Mishpat, we refer to the Jewish courts. On the other hand, the Torah does recognize that the non-Jews do have an obligation to set up justice systems too. As a matter of fact, I mentioned earlier, what some Rishonim say, that the reason the residents of Shem were guilty, were liable for the death penalty is because they failed to have a system of justice. And the Poskim often, again, it's a topic beyond the scope of our discussion today, the Poskim do often recognize that even if their laws deviate from the Torah, even if they're more strict or less strict, or even if their laws are not the laws of the Torah, but as long as they're making a good faith effort to have justice, the Torah does recognize that as being valuable. As a matter of fact, the Gemara has one story. It says that one of the Amorim, or Tanaim, or Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, was actually employed as an investigator by the, I don't know, Babylonian government to catch thieves. He was kind of like Sherlock Holmes. He would be able to figure out who the thieves were, and he would turn them over to the government, and the government would kill them. And they were killing Jewish thieves, which of course is not the penalty, not the halakhic penalty for theft. And it says that some of his rabbinic colleagues had kindness on him. They said, what are you doing? You're killing Jews. And he said, well, they're bad Jews. He said, they're kotzim ani mechalem and akerem, destroying the thorns from the vineyard. They said, no, yavah balakerem v'yachales kotzim. Let God, the owner of the vineyard, let him take care of it. You shouldn't be doing it. But many posts can rule in accordance with his view that it is permitted to cooperate with the secular justice system, even if their laws are not strictly according to Torah, as long as they're trying to as long as they're making a well-meaning effort to enforce some kind of justice and law and order, even though it's not the ultimate ideal, law of the Torah, we still recognize that as being a legitimate thing.
Especially if the Jewish law cannot enforce anything.
That's also true, especially in cases where we don't have our own power. Then certainly many posters say that we have to respect and defer to the law of the land. So in this case, the appeal was asked: should the community file this complaint and thereby trigger an autopsy? His answer was yes, they should. And he gave various reasons, arguments why. One of his arguments is, again, this idea, maybe revenge is not the right word, deterrence, he said. Same as the Tzemach Tzedek, it is important, he said, for the enemies, the criminals, to know that there will be a price if they attack a Jew. And therefore, it's important for the murderer not to think he's going to get away with it. We have to, and even though the mace will be desecrated, even though the poor victim will be desecrated, so he says, it's worth it. It's worth forcing him to accept a short-term problem, a short-term penalty, in exchange for preserving the long-term health and stability of the Jewish community.
As far as a lot of these things,
we'll hopefully, if we have time, we'll get to that, at least touch on that a little bit later. It's much less of an issue, but we will discuss at least some aspects of that question. So not only that, just one last tshuva on this point. It's a tshuva in the Ramah. These two tshuvas, the Tzemach Tzedek and the Bir Malkiel, were discussing non-Jewish murders. There's even a tshuva of the Ramah, the Ramah in the Shulchan Aruch. He has a tshuva where he was asked, there was a Jewish criminal, a Jewish fellow who had become a criminal, a bandit, he apparently had murdered somebody even. He was caught by the non-Jewish government, the Polish government, apparently. And they were going to kill him for his various crimes, I think including the murder. And the Jewish community had some influence over whether to encourage the government to basically file a brief in favor of his execution, against his execution. They had some influence over what his fate should be. And the question came to the Ramah, what position should we take? Should we ask for him to be released? Should we ask for him to be killed? Should we be neutral? And what should we do? The Ramah felt, for various reasons, that they should go along with his execution. They should even, I think, encourage his execution. He gave a number of reasons why. And one of the reasons was, it's important, he says, that the non-Jews not think that we don't take crime seriously. It's important first of all, he said, because of the Chil Hashem, but also he said, if they think that we don't care about murder, or we don't enforce murders, or we encourage murders to be let go, the next time somebody murders a Jew, if it's a non-Jew, they'll say, all right, you know, Jews don't really care. Jews think that murder should be a slap on the wrist and let go.
They might do that anyway,
okay. But we have to do at least our part to show them that we think murder is very serious and we think there should be a penalty. We have to do whatever we can to show, to enforce a culture of consequences, of justice, as you're saying, of a notion that actions have consequences and you will not simply get away with things, at least to the extent that
that's a neutral position, right? It's not that it encourages the death penalty.
I think he actually encourages the death penalty, but I have to review the truth, but I think he actually encourages it. He goes on, you want to hear something really, really, really interesting, he goes on to say, some people suggested that they should do something short of the death penalty. They should maybe impose some other punishment. They should beat him, lash him, something. They should do something short of death. He says, not a good idea. Right, luck with the death. He says, not a good idea. He says, I'm not sure if he killed a non-Jew or a Jew in this case, but Ramah goes on and says, there was once a case when he was young, a case where involved his Rebbe, the famous Jewish leader, Rabbi Shachna. He says, there was a certain Jewish person who was guilty of serious crimes, was a major scoundrel, and needed to be punished. So there was a debate, apparently, over whether to actually kill him or just impose some other punishment on him. And the lenient faction won out. They decided, instead of killing him, they blinded him and they cut out his tongue. This guy then was so bitter and so angry, he became a mishumet, he became a Catholic. He married a non-Jew, and he became a lifelong enemy, not surprisingly, of the Jewish community, and he caused them, you know, endless amounts of trouble. So the Ramah says, the lesson is, when you shoot to kill. When you punish somebody, you don't go halfway. If you're gonna make an enemy, then you make sure he's a dead enemy,
Look, this is all very interesting, but the Jewish view on giving lashes and stuff like that is, instead of giving 40, We give 39 because we have a compassionate idea of.
But we also execute people, not kill people.
Okay, so this is some rabbi that says that.
Okay, but important rabbi.
Okay, but the Torah, overall Torah view is to be merciful when giving the death penalty.
So I should clarify, yes, both points are true. Phil is right. There are many places in the Torah says, even when we kill people, we're merciful, the Torah says, we make all kinds of lawyerly excuses not to kill people. There is definitely one strain of...
Isn't it the major strain?
Perhaps it's the major strain, but on the other hand, there is also very much a kind of cold-blooded attitude that we live in a tough world and we do have to preserve we do have to maintain some kind of strict justice and deterrence. We'll discuss now one other example. We see both these values in tension. Very similar case to the case of the Ramah. This is in the Chavos Yar, about 300 years ago. Again, dealing with a Jewish criminal, a Jewish guy who had fallen in with criminal elements. He became a gang member of some sort. He actually murdered somebody, got away with it. He murdered a Jewish person, not a non-Jew. This Jewish criminal murdered a Jew. Wasn't caught, continued in his criminal career. Eventually, he was caught by the government, the European government, not for the murder. He was caught for theft, some kind of lesser crime. But in those days, they were very strict. I'm sorry?
Jews are caught for taxes.
Yes, right. He was caught for some kind of theft, maybe taxes, maybe highway robbery. I don't know if it was white-collar crime, blue-collar crime. But whatever it was, he was eventually caught for theft. In those days, the penalty for theft was often the death penalty also. And he was basically on trial for his life for theft, not for the murder. They didn't get him for the murder. So again, the question came to the Chavos Yar, what should the Jewish community do? Again, three possibilities. Should we actively intervene to get him killed, because he's a murderer after all? We know he's a murderer, even if they didn't catch him for that. Should we try to get him off, because he's a Jew, he's our brother, we should have compassion? Or should we stay neutral? Should we not get involved? Should we tell the government, whatever you do, we're not mixing in? So the Chavos Yar's final answer is, we're not mixing in.
If we don't mix in,
he might or he might not. I don't know if it was clear he's going to get killed, or that. I'm not sure if it was a foregone conclusion. But it's a good point. I'm not sure if the death penalty was a foregone conclusion or not. But either way, his answer was that we should not mix in.
There's a big difference between being neutral and trying to impose whatever side, right? Because when you're neutral, the statement is your system. I abide by your system.
Yes.
Regardless of what happens.
Right. And that was his answer, that we should stay neutral, not take either side. And his arguments were that to actively try to get him killed is the wrong thing to do. Compassion. We should not be killing him. We should not actively. On the other hand, he says he is a criminal. He is guilty. He is a murderer, and we should not actively be trying to save a murderer's life either.
But in a case where if you're not actively trying to get him killed, he would be let off. If you weren't trying to do it, then you should.
He should what?
Then you should be actively trying.
Try to get him killed. No, so the Chavos Yar felt that you should not get him killed. And just to discuss
what... No, but if otherwise he would be completely let off.
I mean, you wouldn't even go to jail, you mean, or anything.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. My understanding is, after we read the Shuvah again, my understanding is the Chavos Yar would still say you should not get involved. And we'll discuss now what some of his arguments were. Most of the Chavos Yar's Shuvah revolves around another theme I want to discuss today. That is something actually from next week's Parsha, from Parsha's Maaseh. Not directly, no. Not really. It's a big topic. It's a big topic. There are a lot of there are many different angles to this. But let's discuss at least now what the Chavos Yar is talking about. He discussed something from next week's parasha, that is the notion of Goel Hadam. The Torah says that when somebody kills, there is a Goel Hadam, that is a relative of the murdered man. And he has the right, or even the duty, to avenge the murder of his relative by killing the murderer. Now, there is a whole discussion in the Talmud about, first of all, whether it's actually a mitzvah or just rishus, just permission. And there's a considerable debate among the Rishonim exactly how we paskin, whether it's a mitzvah or a rishus. But there definitely is a sheet that the Rambam himself seems to hold like this, that it is a mitzvah, at least in the case, the Torah mostly talks about a murderer b'shogeg, someone who kills accidentally. There is definitely an opinion, the Rambam sees it all this way, the Ramban, that at least in the case of a murderer b'mezid, someone who deliberately kills, that there is actually a mitzvah of Goel Hadam for the relative of the victim to avenge the murder of his relative by killing back, killing the murderer. So Chavos Yair's tshuva revolves largely around this concept of Gol Hadam, whether this applies halacha l'maisa in contemporary times. If someone's relative is murdered, should he do the mitzvah of Gol Hadam by killing the murderer? He argues, and some people had argued in his case, that encouraging the government to kill this guy would be the fulfillment of the mitzvah of Gol Hadam. He argues strongly against that for many reasons. He has probably four or five different reasons. One reason is he feels that this was only in the time of Chazal, where they had Sanhedrin and they had capital punishment. Today we don't get involved in capital punishment. One argument. Second argument, he says, is that even if you want to do Gol Hadam, you still have to have a proper hearing with Eidim. You have to have due process. You can't just allow people to go around killing you. The basin has to have Eidim, and they have to formally accept the Eidim. He also argues that Gol Hadam means that
Gol Hadam happens before there's a trial.
So that's a good point. I was skipping over the complications. There are actually probably at least three different types of Gol Hadam. There's one type of killing the guy before he gets to the basin, before he gets to the Aramaic foot. That's why the Torah says, make sure you have signs, like the hospital sign. Make sure you have signs in the road so you shouldn't catch him before he has a chance to go to their miklat. So before the trial, he's supposed to go to their miklat, and the Gol Hadam could theoretically kill him, but we hope he gets there on time so he gets the right to have a trial before. There's another idea of Gol Hadam that after a trial, let's say he's found to be shogig and he's found to be not a murderer mazid, then he has the right to remain in the Gol Hadam, remain in the Eir Miklat, and the Gol Hadam cannot kill him as long as he remains in the sanctuary city. But if he leaves, then the Gol Hadam can kill him. There's a third aspect of Gol Hadam, that a murderer of a mazid, someone who kills deliberately, has no refuge in the Eir Miklat, and the Gol Hadam can kill him anywhere. These are all different aspects of Gol Hadam, but you're right, there is one phase of Gol Hadam, which is before the trial, but there's also another phase involving a murderer of a mazid, a deliberate murder, for which the Gol Hadam retains the indefinite right.
So in the case of a mazid, what comes first? I mean, whatever comes first is what it's binded by halacha, like if the Gol Hadam.
So the Rambam, for example, the way the Rambam brings down the halacha, he says that after Basin decides he's guilty, they nominate the Gol Hadam to kill, and they say, okay, you're the relative, you should take the first shot, you should be the one to do it. If he can't do it, then Basin says, okay, we'll do it. But today we have no Basin who can do it. Like you said, no Basin can do it. So some poskim said, the Chavos Yair said, no, no Basin, then the whole thing is obsolete, no Gol Hadam without Basin. Other poskim, including the Tzemach Tzedek, one of the Tzemach Tzedek's arguments we discussed before, the idea of deterrence, of making sure it doesn't happen again. One of his other arguments, though, is that there is a mitzvah of Gol Hadam. That applies not to the whole community, but to the relatives of the victim. They have a specific mitzvah, he says. He doesn't care the fact there's no Sanhedrin, no Eidim, that doesn't bother him. Many Acharim debate this point back and forth, whether you need Eidim, you don't need Eidim, you need Sanhedrin, you don't need Sanhedrin, but the fact is that there are the poskim, the Acharonim are split on this question of whether, as a halacha l'maisa, whether Gol Hadam. Now again, the case where we have a government who doesn't allow this, who doesn't, I'm not saying in America in the 21st century you should be doing this, but at least in principle, the fact that we have no Sanhedrin and no proper system of Eidim, does that stop us from doing Gol Hadam? That is a major machlokas, and there's no real consensus in the Acharonim of whether some say yes, some say no. But the Acharonim are split on whether the mitzvah of Gol Hadam still applies. Another objection raised by the Chavos Yair is that the Gol Hadam himself is supposed to kill him, but telling the government to kill him, that's not Gol Hadam. Unless you do it yourself, it's not Gol Hadam. Tzemach Tzedek says no. Gol Hadam means get the job done, however you get it done. He gives examples. Just like the mitzvah to teach your kid Torah. If you can't do it, if you don't have the time, if you're working, sorry? Exactly, you pay a teacher. He says, Bris Mila. Torah tells the father, Mitzvah Avala Ben, the Torah tells the father to do the Bris Mila. Most of us don't do it ourselves. Most of us hire a Imo. Same thing here, he says. The Torah says that it's the job of the relatives to avenge the murderer of their relative. They can't do it for whatever reason, then they get it done, however they can, hire somebody else. Other posts can say no, especially, certainly through non-Jews you shouldn't do it, and some posts can say it has to be you yourself. So that's another debate about practically speaking, for most of us, Gol Hadam wouldn't involve doing it ourselves, it would be involving courts or governments or hitmen or whatever, be involving somebody else. That's actually a debate about whether the mitzvah of Gol Hadam includes that kind of activity. One other very interesting idea, again, justice, deterrence, vengeance, you can use different words for it, but one other idea discussed by the poskim, this might sound very strange, but it's an interesting idea. You know, many of us have heard campfire stories. There's a popular idea in folk tales and there's an idea that if somebody is murdered, his soul does not rest, is disturbed until the murderer is caught and put to and punished. So a couple of Akharim, different Malkiel and Lechavasyar, both say that that is an authentic Jewish idea. They both bring different examples from Pesukim, from Chazal, that the Torah recognizes this too. So for example, there's a famous Medrash, we speak about it on Tisha B'Av, we have a whole keen about this on Tisha B'Av. It says that at the end of the destruction of the second temple, the first temple, it says that the enemy, Nebuzaradan, the Babylonians, came into the Beit HaMikdash, and they saw there was blood just boiling, disturbed, motion of blood on the temple, the Azara floor, and they asked what's going on. So eventually they were told the truth, that the Jews, they have been so wicked, they have been such Rishayim, that when Zechariah the Navi, when he used to give them Musar, he would tell them to behave themselves, to stop sinning. They got so angry and so tired of listening to him, they killed him. And this is such a heinous crime. He was a Navi, and he was a Kohen, and he was a Tzaddik. It was such a terrible thing that his blood was disturbed and just would keep on going, and as a complaint, as a kitrug against Klal Yisrael. And the Medrash says, and Buzaradan, this general, kept slaughtering Jews to kind of make it stop. He kept slaughtering Jews until finally he was so disturbed by what he had done that he himself became a Baal Tshuva. He saw that the Kosh Baruch Hu was the onesh, the punishment was so great. But in any event, the Medrash implies that the blood of Zechariah was agitated and would not rest until there was some punishment, some justice against Klal Yisrael for doing what they did. Similarly, there's a story in Malachim. Achav, one of the evil kings of Israel, one of his most terrible acts was that the story of Navas HaKarmeli. There was a story of Navas who had owned a vineyard which the king wanted. The king coveted. He asked him to sell it. He wouldn't sell it, so he trumped up false witnesses. He had him killed unjustly. So later, Achav eventually was killed in battle. And the Navi tells us, how did Achav die? So it says, on the evening of the battle, the day before the battle, in Shemayim, so Hashem said, who is going to come and punish Achav? Achav is a Rasha. Who's going to come and punish Achav? So it says, the spirit of Navas, the dead Navas who he had killed, the spirit of Navas said, I'm going to get him. And sure enough, it says, the spirit of Navas went down and manipulated things. Achav got killed. He made false nevuahs that he should go into war, that he would win. He gave him false confidence, and he got him killed. So the Mefarshim say, the different Malkiel and the Chavasyar say that
he couldn't do any physical harm.
Right. The implication is he didn't directly kill him. He didn't like possess him and strangle him or anything like that. But he manipulated him psychologically, played mind games with him, and got him killed. But the idea, the different Malkiel and the Chavasyar say that the basic idea behind both these stories, of Zechariah, of Navas, of other stories, is that when someone is killed monstrously, unjustly, his soul does not rest until his murder is punished. They say in the Kabbalistic tradition, the Zohar has such an idea. So they say that therefore every time we discuss vengeance or justice or punishing murderers, besides the just justice and doing the right thing, we also have to remember that the murdered victim himself has an interest there. He himself is the other side of the coin. He himself has the right to have his soul needs the rest, needs the menucha of having his murderer killed. So the different Malkiel, for example, I mentioned earlier, his case was they were going to file a criminal complaint against the murderer. That would trigger an autopsy being done. So the different Malkiel says, it's okay. Before I mentioned, one of his reasons was deterrence, because you have to preserve the penalty for killing Jews. Another reason he says is that one of the few reasons that we actually disturb a mace, disturb a corpse, is for his own benefit. So commonly the idea is you want to bring him to Eretz Yisrael. Sometimes they'll dig up a mace and transport him to Eretz Yisrael. Sometimes they do it for family, to bring him next to his family. But in this case, the Malkiel says, this is his benefit, to have his murderer caught. That is something he would want. He needs it. So that's a reason to do it. And that's why the Chavasyar says also that in his case, that's why we should not intercede to get him off, even though he said we should not intercede to get him killed, because Gal Adam doesn't apply and we have no right, we can't play God, we can't kill people, he says. Even indirectly, we can't even call for his death. On the other hand, he says, we should not get him off, because there's two sides to this. The murdered victim also has rights there, he says. We have no right to help the murderer if that will come at the expense of the rest and peace of the murdered victim. So the answer is, like you said, Sheval Tassi, we do nothing. We simply punt, we defer to the court. We say, we're not taking sides, we're not getting involved. You do, you know, you do what you have to do. You do what the law says. And we are not getting involved.
Does this apply as far as the Shem? If they're killed by somebody because they're Russian, do they still have the same
need to get revenge, you mean? It's an interesting question. The example of Zechariah certainly was a tzaddik. The example of Navas, I don't know if Navas is described, I don't know much about him, how he's described by Chazal. It's an interesting question. I don't know offhand. I'm just going to point out that, although, as I mentioned earlier, the Goel Hadam issue, there are different views in the poskim about whether Goel Hadam applies in contemporary times or not. We do have a number of tshuvas in the Rishonim already that imply that Goel Hadam was, in some manner, was still practiced in the time of the Rishonim. So, for example, it's a very interesting line in the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah says that he quotes just a very brief excerpt of one of the tshuvas in the Rishonim, the Maharam Mirzberg. He quotes a tshuva that it says that in a certain case, it says someone was murdered and the man's sons, in Hilchah Shabbos, it says they traveled outside the Tchum on Shabbos to take revenge against the murderer of their father. It doesn't say exactly what they did, but it says they traveled outside the Tchum. And it was okay. So the Mishnah Berurah brings this from the Magen Avraham. The Magen Avraham brings this from the Knesset Gedolah, the second, third, fourth hand source. The Knesset Gedolah brings it from the original source, but their excerpt is very brief. They just say they took revenge on somebody and they went outside the Tchum on Shabbos. So the Mishnah Berurah says, Magen Avraham says, since when are you allowed to travel outside the Tchum, even if you have a good reason, even if it's a mitzvah, you're not allowed to just go outside the Tchum on Shabbos. Moshe Feinstein in the Tshuva says, what's this mitzvah, taking revenge on people who killed your father? What mitzvah is it? Maybe it means Goel Adam, I don't know, he says. But if you look at the Tshuva inside, yes, he means Goel Adam. He discusses it at some length. He says they took revenge, it was a mitzvah of Goel Adam. It was a good thing, it was a great idea, they fulfilled the mitzvah of Goel Adam. And even about Tchum, he gives a technical explanation for why going after the Tchum was permitted. He doesn't say exactly what they did, whether they killed a guy, whether they turned him over to the government, whether they took some other revenge. Doesn't say exactly what they did, but he does say that it was a mitzvah of Goel Hadam, and he does say that even if it involved traveling outside of the Tchum on Shabbos, it was still mutter and it was still a good idea. That's true, but that generally means that you passively don't do a mitzvah. Like you don't take lulav because you're busy with taking care of a sick person, but you can't actually do an aveir, you can't eat chazer, you can't chal Shabbos. Nevertheless, he says he has a technical argument for why it was mutter. Just you asked earlier about nekama and minor things. There is actually a Gemara, I discussed this with my Nikol a little bit, there is actually a Gemara which seems to say that nekama only applies, the Isser of nekama, lo sikam, only applies if someone does a financial negative thing to you. If he burns your property, you shouldn't burn down his barn. If he doesn't lend you his, the Gemara's example, he doesn't lend you his car, you shouldn't. If you're entitled to in court, you can. But also, the Gemara seems to imply if he hits you and you hit him back, that's not an accompaniment. Because a person's understood that a person has the right to fight back. Now, the Chafetz Chaim in the introduction to Hilchos Shmiras Halashon tries to argue that we don't pass him like that, that even if someone hits you, you still have a law from the Kamak, which some showed him not to fight back. But even the Chafetz Chaim agrees, and again, I discussed with Manaikol, even the Chafetz Chaim agrees that there are ample sources in the Rishonim for the idea. And in the heat of the moment, if you fight back, the Torah understands that people are human and that you can't expect somebody to just turn the other cheek when he's hit. So in the spur of the moment, many Mefarshim say that there's a certain level of dispensation you have to fight back. Afterward, to take revenge or cold a day later, there is a Gemara that seems to indicate that it might not be auster. You certainly shouldn't do it. It's still meaning to concede not to do it. There is a certain idea that you might be allowed to do it even a day later. If someone hit you or insulted you and did more than a financial negative thing to you, but there the Chafetz Chaim says, or Rishon would disagree, and he says, L'chatchila, you should not do that. You should be machmir, not take revenge, even if someone did tzara de gufa, even if he started up with you physically.